Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, and Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this January 23rd oral argument panel. We have four cases on our calendar today, three live and one by interactive video. Actually, they're all live, but one will be electronic as opposed to in person. The first matter on for oral argument this morning is Mason Kimmons v. State of Minnesota. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, as we do keep track of the arguments in our audio recording that we provide to the public. There is a button in or a switch in front of the lectern so you can raise or lower the platform to your convenience. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to go, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent Teasel Mason Kimmons on this appeal. Mr. Mason Kimmons received deficient representation when his attorney told him that he should plead guilty because the attorney was unprepared for trial. This court has already ruled on that point. The only issue now is whether Mr. Mason Kimmons was prejudiced by his attorney's deficient advice. Prejudice exists if there is a reasonable probability that Mr. Mason Kimmons would not have pleaded guilty if his attorney had not advised him to do so because the attorney was unprepared for trial. A reasonable probability is a low standard that does not even require a 50% likelihood. A reasonable probability exists if the record undermines this court's confidence that Mr. Mason Kimmons would have made the same plea decision had his attorney never offered the deficient advice. For three reasons, the record must undermine this court's confidence that Mr. Mason Kimmons would have made the same decision if his attorney had never told him to plead guilty because the attorney was unprepared. First, the advice given by the attorney inevitably altered Mr. Mason Kimmons' rational cost-benefit analysis of the plea.
If we agree with that, why did we remand it for the post-conviction evidentiary hearing that the district court conducted?
This court, the last time this case was in front of this court concluded that the district court had applied the incorrect prejudice standard by using the prejudice standard for trials, essentially, and focusing on whether there was a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different if he'd received deficient representation, if the attorney had not performed efficiently. So the remand was for the district court to apply the correct prejudice standard that's used in plea cases for ineffective assistance of counsel, which focuses on whether there's a reasonable probability that the defendant would have made a different plea decision if the attorney would have performed effectively. So that was the basis for the remand. So this court never reached the substantive question of whether the advice prejudiced Mr. Mason Kimmons or not.
But you're suggesting, I think, in your first argument that we don't really need to decide that anyway because of the nature of the ineffective assistance. And what's the legal support for that argument?
Beginning with the way the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has discussed ineffective assistance in the plea context, and that's a focus on the defendant's decision-making. So that first argument grounds the analysis in the defendant's decision-making. As the U.S. Supreme Court instructed courts to do in Lee versus United States, and by looking at decision-making, the decision a defendant makes when pleading guilty is whether to go to trial or to plead guilty. That's the fundamental analysis. That's the fundamental question. The attorney's advice in this case made the value of a trial significantly lower. The attorney told him that he would be ineffective at that trial. That reduced the value of the trial, and that necessarily altered the way Mr. Mason Kimmons thought about his plea and made a plea more attractive relative to a trial because the value of a trial was less because the attorney told him that he would be ineffective at that trial. So that's...
Can you give us a little factual background, at least for my benefit, for context? Okay, there was a finding by this court that counsel said he would be ineffective if he were to go to trial. He wasn't prepared. What does the record tell us about You know, he wasn't prepared in what capacity? He hadn't read the file. He hadn't interviewed witnesses whose location was known, or there were witnesses he hoped to interview, but he hadn't been able to track them down. How was he unprepared?
Sure. And I can address that. I would just note that this court has already found he was unprepared and that he advised his client to plead guilty because he was unprepared.
I agree, but I think that the extent of his preparedness could impact a determination of prejudice. Here's what I'm thinking. I mean, if a lawyer shows up and says, well, I'm not prepared because my client tells me there's a witness out there who will say this, and I've been looking for months. I have yet to find him, and until I find that witness, we're not prepared for trial. That's different than a lawyer who says, I was assigned this case a month ago from another lawyer. I've got a book schedule. I don't have time to even begin strategy on this case. Do you see what I mean? Those are two extremes, but I think where preparedness falls on that spectrum influences, to some extent, you know, the client's decision-making.
I understand what you're saying, Judge Larkin. I would just push back a little bit. I think what matters is what Mr. Mason Kimmons was told. So to the extent that the attorney explained the reasons he was unprepared to Mr. Mason Kimmons.
Do we know that then?
He did. On the so at the August 9th hearing, the attorney stated that he's unprepared for trial. He said that if he went to trial, he would provide ineffective assistance of counsel to Mr. Mason Kimmons. The reasons why he made that statement was because he said he was not prepared to examine potential witnesses, to cross-examine witnesses. He also gave testimony to that effect at the 2020 evidentiary hearing. So that was his basis for being unprepared, that the state had additional discovery that came in on that he hadn't looked at as of 4 days before trial. So he appeared on August 9th. He still hadn't looked at the last batch of discovery. He told the court that he was unprepared, primarily based on not being able to review that discovery, which made him unprepared to examine witnesses, unprepared to determine the precise defense strategy. That's what he said. He said it to some extent in 2018. He said it again in the subsequent evidentiary hearings.
Gist of it was his inability to find a witness that his client believed was going to be favorable and would undermine statements that had been made by this witness earlier, correct?
That was part of it, but that wasn't the only issue. Again, there was other discovery that he hadn't reviewed yet, and he felt that he would not be able to provide effective examinations of witnesses based on not having looked at that material.
One problem I'm having with your argument. It seems to conflate the lack of preparation with the actual ineffective assistance in saying, I'm not ready, so you better plead guilty. I mean, this court, I think in the second time it was up here, said, I mean, the ineffectiveness is the misadvice,
yes.
Not the fact that he hadn't been able to find a witness or that he hadn't in the 4 days or whatever since the prosecutor had submitted additional evidence, gotten through it yet.
I entirely agree with you that that's the issue. It's the advice. That's all this court should be looking at, whether that advice, if there's a reasonable probability that that advice altered Mr. Mason Kimmons' decision-making.
Go ahead.
I mean, is that really our question? Whether there's a reasonable probability or whether there was sufficient basis for the district court to make that decision.
This court reviews ineffective assistance claims de novo, the ultimate legal question of whether the attorney performed.
But this part of it is a fact question, isn't it?
Well, it's a legal analysis based on, it's a mixed question. So the court makes factual findings, but it's a legal analysis of whether those factual findings establish a reasonable probability or not.
I mean, there's a hearing, and the district court has to weigh the evidence and decide how much the ineffective assistance influenced your client.
Yes.
And that's ultimately something you do eyeballing the witnesses and hearing the testimony.
I disagree. I think this court does that exact same analysis based on the record that it has. Now, there are certain rules on reviewing a post-conviction where the amount of deference that...
Isn't this part of it, weighing the evidence, though?
If the court, to the extent that the district court made factual findings, this court applies clear error to those factual findings. I mean, there is deference, but the ultimate legal question of whether or not the facts establish a reasonable probability that Mr. Mason Kimmons would have made a different plea decision. That is a legal question. This court's repeatedly said that. The Minnesota Supreme Court said that. And that's a legal question that's reviewed de novo. So that's the standard we'd ask this court to apply.
To the facts. Which findings of fact in the district court's order do you assert are clearly erroneous?
I mean, the district court's order, well, there are a few facts that were clear erroneous that I can get into. First, the district court found that the pretrial issues influenced Mr. Mason Kimmons' decision to plead guilty, that his ruling on the pretrial issues influenced that. The record shows that the court had not ruled on any of those pretrial issues.
Other than the motion to continue, which it had ruled on and denied again.
But not the pretrial
issues. Not the evidentiary.
Not the evidentiary issues. And that's what the district court was referring to when it referenced pretrial issues in disorder. So that's one erroneous finding of fact. District court found that the plea discussions did not begin until August 13th, the day of trial. That was the first reference to Mr. Reed being unprepared. So the district court had the timeline wrong on key events as well. But the main flaw in district court's analysis was it was incorrectly focused on the attorney's level of preparation. So it was more of a legal error, which it continued from what it did the last time of focusing on the attorney's preparation, which is only goes to deficiency and doesn't go towards prejudice.
Then it gets back to my earlier concern about the conflation of the issue of right. preparation and whether that was ineffective assistance
right.
versus the misadvice.
But the district court, yep.
Well, and I think you continue to argue now that the significance of the lack of preparation. So, I mean, I understand the argument you're making, but doesn't that in some respects reflect the nature of the arguments you're presenting to the district court?
No, it doesn't. We did not argue anything about the attorney's level of preparation in this last hearing. And we specifically argued that the court should not be looking at the attorney's preparation. So it was the district court that conflated the issues. It wasn't us. We've always said that prejudice turns on the defendant's decision-making, so it turns on whether Mr. Mason Kimmons was influenced by his attorney's advice that he should plead guilty because the attorney was unprepared for trial. That's the issue.
The fact of lack of preparation was well known to everybody. Isn't that, I mean, because there have been multiple motions to continue based on I haven't been able to find these witnesses. Isn't that one of the circumstances your client objectively considered in deciding whether to plead guilty as opposed to go to trial?
When this court's looking at the prejudice analysis focuses on the deficient performance. So, and it's a question of whether that deficient performance had an effect on the decision making.
And what's the deficient performance?
The advice that Mr. Mason Kimmons should plead guilty because the attorney was unprepared for trial. That's what this court ruled was the deficient performance, and that's law of the case. And the record shows that the attorney gave that advice to Mr. Mason Kimmons, and this court correctly found that advice was deficient.
Here, I mean, this is, and I understand it's the law of the case, but I'm just struggling a little bit with that concept because any lawyer could show up and say to his client, I'm not prepared for trial, despite the fact that he had every opportunity to be prepared for trial, so you should plead guilty because I'm not prepared. And now we're in this position of, well,
that would always be deficient representation.
Yeah, and how are we to know, if we can't consider the extent of the preparation, how are we to know or what the defendant knew about the extent of the preparation, such as the district court tried to do? It seems like it would just always be, okay, retrial. The way you get your continuance is just to show up and advise your client that you're not prepared, regardless of whether or not you had time to be prepared. I know that's beyond the facts we have here, but that's why I'm struggling with what do we do with this?
And I mean, attorneys have ethical obligations, and some of the assumptions that this court makes in every case is that attorneys are being honest and forthright. And by the same token, defendants rely on that. They rely on the assumption that their attorney is being honest with them. So, you know, to say that Mr. Mason Kimmons should have somehow seen through the true motives of his attorney when his attorney's telling him, plead guilty because I'm going to give you ineffective assistance at trial, I mean, that's inconsistent with the way that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has talked about an attorney's duties, about how an attorney is a defendant's trusted advisor to whom the defendant is entitled to rely on loyalty and honesty. So, I mean, Mr. Mason Kimmons had to believe, had to take his attorney at his word that he was unprepared for trial.
Could you have argued, or could the argument in the first case have been ineffective assistance of counsel because he wasn't prepared for trial? So was it a matter of selecting the strategy? We either go in and say, my attorney was ineffective because he wasn't prepared for trial, or we just go in and say, my attorney told me to plead guilty because he wasn't prepared for trial? Because it seems like the method you pick opens up different possibilities.
Well, I mean, honestly, this court picked. I mean, those facts were before this court the last time, and this court said what was deficient was the advice. The advice that the client should plead guilty because the attorney was unprepared. That's what this court found. So it wasn't a matter of strategy by appellant. It was what this court found. This court looked at the record and said this is what was deficient. So now the task before this court is whether that deficient performance caused Mr. Mason-Kimmons prejudice. And I'll get more into this in rebuttal, but very briefly, the other key strand of this is everything about the record suggested Mr. Mason-Kimmons was on the way to trial up until August 9th when the attorney said he was unprepared. And that trial strategy was supported by evidence that the defense had before it, that witnesses said in police reports gave a description of the shooter that was different than Mr. Mason-Kimmons, that described the shooter as someone in his 20s, someone who was tall and lanky, someone who was 6'2", someone who had dark skin. Mr. Mason-Kimmons fit none of that criteria. He was a light-skinned African-American male. He was stocky. He was 5'10". So the defense had a viable strategy, and they were on that course until August 9th when the attorney said, I'm unprepared, I can't go to trial. And we argue that corroborates everything that they've said, that Mr. Mason-Kimmons took this plea because of his attorney's deficient advice.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. The court can't just look at the advice that was given to Mr. Mason-Kimmons. Look at the decision in Gates versus State, there's discussion about the contemporaneous evidence that needs to be considered. That's why here it's essential that the post-conviction evidentiary hearings, it's been remanded twice, took place in front of the same judge who was the trial judge, the same judge who was there and had discussions with Mr. Reed regarding his level of preparation. And his level of preparation here, to answer Judge Larkin's question, it was about witnesses he wanted. It had nothing to do with a late disclosure or...
What does it matter?
What does it matter?
Why does that matter if the question is whether the advice, whether being informed that your lawyer is not ready to defend you, how that affects the decision to plead guilty? You should plead guilty because I'm not ready to go to trial. So, whether he was extremely well prepared and just was a little bit lacking, or completely oblivious to the facts of the case. I'm speaking of the lawyer. Why would that matter to the client who's told, you go to trial, essentially, implicitly, probably going to lose?
I think it matters because if an individual is saying that he or she is not ready to defend someone at trial, that goes to the weight of what they're saying. However, I think even though I admit I conceded that making that statement in this case was deficient representation at the time, if you look at the context, the credibility of that statement is questionable.
Well, for lawyers.
Yes.
But for an individual, an unsophisticated individual, not trained in the law, your lawyer is telling you. I mean, if you were being rolled in on a gurney and you're thinking, maybe I should have heart surgery, and your surgeon says, you know, I'm a cardiologist, I'm not ready to perform the surgery. I mean, that's all you need to know, isn't it? That would be the thing that influences your decision. You don't have the insight to question what that means.
That might tip the scales to make your decision. I agree with that. But I think you also do have to look at the contemporaneous evidence because that's what the case law says. And the assertions about the amount of readiness are somewhat troubling when you look at the actual testimony in the evidentiary hearing and you look at the admissions that Mr. Reed makes where he says that he did review the police reports with his client and that he had talked to his client about the strategies that they were going to take. And he also talks about wanting to basically pin the case on an eyewitness credibility determination when there's evidence in the record showing that one of the witness statements that he reviewed, I believe it was on August 9th, discovery was available August 1st, but he reviewed it August 9th, was something that was obviously wrong based on the surveillance footage. The witness statement that he was kind of hinging some credibility on was an orange sweatshirt was worn by the shooter when the video shows that, in fact, it was a blue sweatshirt. Also, the belief that there was a witness who was going to say that Mr. Mason Kimmins had not been the shooter recanted that statement.
Well, practically speaking, how do these things work into our review of the district court's decision about the effect of the information that I'm not ready for trial and the decision to plead guilty?
I think they're part of the factors. They're part of the consideration that's looked at, and that's why the district court was in the best position to make the credibility determinations and to look at the facts as a whole. And this court, it is a mixed question of law and fact. However, whether or not there are credibility determinations are entitled to some deference. And here, the district court explicitly found the prosecutor in this case to be credible, who testified that this was the same explanation time and time again. I'm not ready, I'm not ready. And he testified that nothing had really changed. And so it just seemed like a new attempt to get a continuance. And it wasn't as though this was an attorney who was hired 3 days before or a week before. Mr. Reed was hired months before. And so when he's making that statement, which his client does hear in open court, all of the parties are aware of the fact that this is the same statement. And it's difficult to defend what a defense attorney says in that sense, because I don't necessarily agree with what he's saying, and I don't think the court did either, but the court made credibility findings that lead to the inference that he wasn't credible about what he was telling his client. And so I think that we have the law of the case that this fact was told to the client, that he wasn't ready and that he should plead guilty. But you have to also look at perhaps he wasn't getting the information he wanted. In the order, I believe it's on addendum page 10, simply stated it's not the court's job to give an attorney all the time he wants to locate witnesses. And so the district court viewed this as a matter of, I'm not ready because I don't have the case I want. Not necessarily, I'm not ready because I don't have the information at hand. I haven't reviewed the
reports. And you believe the client should have discerned that as well?
I believe, based on the testimony, that Mr. Mason Kimmins was aware of what was missing from his case, the eyewitnesses that they thought would be helpful. There was a recantation of a recantation. And so once he's aware of that and the evidence that is available isn't going to be helpful to him, he made the decision to take a really good offer on a premeditated murder case. Two other cases were dismissed, and he was able to get a probation sentence for his girlfriend, whose registered vehicle was seen at the scene, in which he was spotted getting in and out of before the shooting and after the shooting. I don't think you can just isolate what Mr. Reed said to him. And I don't disagree that Mr. Reed should not have said that to him. I think that that is an ethical issue, and I think that it does put us in a quandary of what do we do when an attorney testifies post hoc, by the way, I said to him he should plead guilty. Like, what position does that put us in?
Let me ask you this. The appellant's counsel has, I think, made some good arguments that the district court erred in at least three of its findings of fact, or how we read the order as separating out findings of fact versus the legal conclusion. But, you know, the discussion of the pretrial evidentiary issues. As I review the record, there hadn't been a ruling on the evidentiary issues, including the critical ones are whether the evidence of the prior assault on the victim and some of that stuff was going to be admissible, the plea, deadlines, and also a finding regarding the nature of the lack of preparation. How do you respond to that argument?
Your Honor, I agree that there are some problems with the order. For instance, the pretrial issues, there had not been a definitive ruling. However, if you look at the testimony from senior assistant county attorney Nick Lindstroth, who was found to be credible by Judge Quam, he said that there was an implicit, the judge kind of pointed the way the wind was going in chambers on August 9th. So the parties might have had an understanding. It wasn't implicitly on the record, I agree. There was not a final order on those pretrial rulings, but it might have been implied where it was going. Additionally, with regard to whether the plea negotiations took place on August 13th or August 10th, I think, if anything, if the negotiations took place on August 10th, that goes to the weight against the argument that there's a reasonable probability but for Mr. Reed's advice that Mr. Mason Kimmins would have pled guilty. If he was already thinking about pleading guilty on August 10th, whatever Mr. Mason Kimmins received as far as information the day of trial essential if he's already thinking about it. And I believe Mr. Lindstroth testified that an email exchange took place on August 10th that was initiated by Mr. Reed asking to accept the state's offer on the condition that Ms. Danowit, his girlfriend's case, would be dismissed. So they were, and that was the Friday before trial. So they were engaged in negotiations.
And
so,
an offer had been made earlier, right?
Yes, it had. And I think it was just a response alerting the state that they were interested in the offer. And then when the negotiations took place, it was all about what was going to happen with Ms. Danowit. The number never changed. 366 didn't change. And so in looking at that, I think it... That's why I think the context and the totality, you can't just isolate the statement, which I agree is not a great statement to make to a defendant about whether or not to plead guilty. But when you look at the context of it, as Gates has us do, as Lee versus United States has us do, you have to consider that. Courts can't just upset a plea solely because of post hoc assertions from a defendant about how he would have pleaded but for his attorney's deficiency. Here we do have some more information based on what his attorney has said, but I would submit to this court that based on the order finding Mr. Lindstroth credible, that Mr. Reed was not found credible. I would appreciate if there would have been an explicit finding of credibility. There's not. However, I think it's helpful to look at what Mr. Lindstroth says and Mr. Reed said cannot square with one another if one is credible and the other is not. That seems to make more sense.
So your argument, and I appreciate Judge Ross's questioning because that's what I'm struggling with. Yeah. If this is really just about an inability to locate a witness, the defendant doesn't have the right to postpone his trial indefinitely until he can find the witness he wants. So that, to me, is important. And if the circumstances are such that, based on what was said in court on the record in front of the defendant understood that unprepared meant, we don't have your witness, I've not been able to find him, I don't know why we can't look at that. There are other circumstances, for example, if an attorney is making a concession of guilt at trial, mm-hmm. where the case law says, well, the defendant was right there, the defendant heard it, we're ascribing that knowledge to the defendant. I don't know why this would be different. Because at the end of the day, it probably is an effective assistance of counsel to say, you should plead guilty, I'm not ready for trial, as opposed to you should consider pleading guilty because your defense hinges on our location of this witness. I've done everything I could to find him. I can't find him, and the judge isn't giving us any more time, and the judge isn't required to give us any more time. It's two different ways of expressing I'm not prepared for trial.
I agree, Your Honor, that there are two different ways with that.
So does this record, could we look at this record, and could the post-conviction court look at the record and say, you know, it was obvious to everybody who was here based on the transcript that unready meant I don't have the witness you want?
I think so, Your Honor. And I think that's exactly what Judge Quam's order says. I think Judge Quam is saying, look, what's happened is the witnesses that both sides are trying to find are not located, and Mr. Reed wants more time to locate them, and he's saying he's not ready, but that's not enough in this case.
But wasn't there more? As I read the decision of this court, decisions of this court, it wasn't just I can't find the witness. It was that I just received a bunch of discovery. I haven't had a chance to go through it. There, when you have these nuances, I'm having a difficult time conceiving of an unsophisticated defendant appreciating the gravity of the "I'm not ready for trial" statement. What is that? What effect does the lack of preparedness on each one of these things do? What does it mean in the mechanics of trial not to be ready in discovery, for example? What happens with that?
I think it depends on the case. And here, I think if we didn't have the additional testimony from the evidentiary hearing where Mr. Reed says that he reviewed the reports and he reviewed the discovery with Mr. Mason Kimmons, then perhaps it would be more of an impact if he's saying, I haven't reviewed all of these things, I haven't talked to him about them. He had the entire weekend to go over it. He also, as Judge Quam pointed out, it's a first-degree murder case, so jury selection is going to take some time. We work nights, we work weekends. That's part of the problem, not problem, that's part of the benefit of being a trial attorney, which is why I'm an appellate attorney. And so I think you just can't look at it in isolation. And also, if you, I lost my thought while trying to be funny there.
That'll teach you.
The information. In my brief, I cite to, I believe it's on, there's a big, long footnote in my brief that talks about what the actual discovery was that was turned over on August 1st. It was available August 1st. I believe Mr. Reed picked it up August 15th. And we disclosed all of that at the last evidentiary hearing as an in-court exhibit to Judge Quam so that he could look to see how much of this really was new, how much of it wasn't. And if you take a look at it, honestly, not a lot of it is new. One of the statements is a statement from Yaki Eason, who's saying that the shooter was wearing an orange sweatshirt. Well, the video shows that's not accurate. It also includes information that was pretty damaging to the defendant's case because it was Mr. Willie Smith saying, I know I said he wasn't the shooter, but really he was the shooter. So that's the recant of the recant. Additionally, there are a couple supplemental reports that are there. There's a transcript of a jail call which had previously been disclosed. I think that's the one in which Mr. Mason Kimmons says he's going to kill Mr. Lacey when he was arrested 3 days earlier. So the strength of the case comes in too. I understand the hesitation with this because of the testimony about what was said. It's concerning, and that's the difficult position that the state is sometimes in, defending the actions of a defense attorney who, it can run the gamut from how helpful a defense attorney will be at a post-conviction evidentiary hearing.
Can I ask you, one of the arguments that the appellant makes is that the district court applied the wrong burden of proof, imposed a higher burden on him to establish prejudice than the law permits. And it's, as I review the law, I mean, it's somewhere between, conceivable possibility. I mean, what does reasonable probability mean? Somewhere between conceivable possibility and preponderance of the evidence. Looks to me like the district court went with the higher burden. Is that a problem? And assuming it is there still a basis for this court to affirm?
First, I don't think the district court applied the wrong burden. I think the district court maybe was not as tight in its writing about what burden was being applied. The reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. And case law says that that necessitates a substantial, not just conceivable, likelihood of a different result. That doesn't mean it's not a low burden, but it's also not like a 10% burden. That is, it's a decent burden. And I think the district court applied it correctly. If this, based on the totality of the circumstances and all the evidence and looking at Gates and looking at Lee, if this court were to disagree, I'm hesitant to recommend that it be remanded a third time, but there's always that option. I think this court could choose to do what it wished with it. Looking at the record as a whole and the fact that it's de novo, I think this court could look and say, even if it applied the appropriate standard, if it thinks the district court didn't apply the appropriate standard, that it would still be sufficient based on the circumstances of this case. I see my time has expired. Unless there are further questions, I respectfully request that this court affirm the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess.
And again, for the record, just go ahead and restate.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm Michael McLaughlin for TESOL Mason Kimmons.
Thank you.
Just to address this issue about Mr. Reed's, what was making him feel unprepared and why he was telling Mr. Mason Kimmons that. Again, we completely agree with Judge Ross's analysis that an unsophisticated defendant getting that advice from an attorney is entitled to rely on it, you know, that the attorney's telling him that he's unprepared for trial and that he should therefore plead guilty. Von Moltke versus Gillies talks about how central the attorney's advice is in the plea process, the attorneys are trusted advisors that the defendant necessarily relies upon when making a plea decision. So regardless of whatever Mr. Reed's actual level of preparation was, the advice is what matters, and that advice prejudiced Mr. Mason Kimmons.
But in assessing prejudice, don't we in fact look at what your client was facing taking out that misadvice? So, I mean, your client knew that his lawyer expressed lack of preparation, had moved the court multiple times to continue the trial, knew that there was an issue there with preparation, but also knew about the nature of the plea offer, the circumstantial evidence. I mean, don't we have to take out that whole defective advice when we analyze whether the facts show are enough to sustain a finding of prejudice?
Right. You're supposed to imagine a scenario where the attorney had not advised Mr. Mason Kimmons to plead guilty because the attorney was unprepared, and then determine whether there's a reasonable probability Mr. Mason Kimmons would have made a different plea decision in that scenario. And there there is evidence showing that he would have made a different plea decision. And, the first is the testimony of Mr. Reed and Mr. Mason Kimmons, which is completely consistent with their contemporary statements at the time of plea and sentencing. So the state's characterized it as post hoc. It's not post hoc. At the plea hearing, Mr. Reed said, I'm unprepared for trial, therefore we should engage in plea discussions. And sentencing, Mr. Mason Kimmons said, I pleaded guilty because my attorney was unprepared for trial. So there's stuff that happened at the time coming from Mr. Reed and Mr. Mason Kimmins, saying that the reason they took this plea was because Mr. Reed told Mr. Mason Kimmins he was unprepared for trial.
So your client's position was, I would have taken the case to trial even that day, even though we had not found our missing witnesses?
Yes, yes. And there are reasons why the record shows that. Again, the identification evidence that the state provided, both in the form of the surveillance video and in the police reports, gave a description of a shooter that did not match Mr. Mason Kimmins. I know the state, in its brief, tried to minimize that difference to 2 inches, but it was more than that. It was build, it was age, and it was more significant height than the state described. It was skin tone. So there are multiple differences that can't be reconciled between the way that the bus driver saw, what the people on the bus saw. It doesn't match Mr. Mason Kimmins. So that was one problem. And then if this court does take the time to look at the surveillance video, and we did this in the evidentiary hearing, but you can, the stills of that video show a dark hand of the shooter that does not match Mr. Mason Kimmins. So the state's case was entirely circumstantial. They had no witness saying Mr. Mason Kimmins was the shooter, and they had multiple witnesses that gave a description different than Mr. Mason Kimmins. So,
but given they also that. had evidence of where the ammunition was found, the vehicle involved, the blue sweatshirt, statements made in the jail. I mean, I think there was also some evidence of your client purchasing a gun after he was released from jail in the days immediately preceding the murder. I mean, that was all the circumstantial evidence.
Sure. Yeah, they did have circumstantial evidence, and we're not disputing that, but there was exonerating evidence that the defense could have relied upon regarding identification. And then if looking at the timeline, the defense didn't even engage in any plea discussions up until August 9th, and everything they did was preparing for a trial posture. And then the intervening event that happened was Mr. Reed coming up and saying that he's unprepared for trial and that his client should plead guilty.
What about Ms. Lawan's implicit argument, the state's implicit argument that, well, you're stuck here. You've got the district court lawyer saying I'm not prepared. Client says, well, I guess I'm stuck. You're not going to let me continue the trial. So either we go to trial and I get to argue ineffective assistance of trial counsel and not being prepared, or I rely upon counsel's statement that counsel's not prepared and I'm pressured involuntarily to plead guilty. And ineffective assistance of counsel in that regard. So, I mean, shouldn't we be concerned about defense counsel sort of manipulating the system in order to either get a continuance or get a later claim on his client's behalf for ineffective assistance?
I think with ineffective assistance, the concern should focus on the defendant. It should focus on ensuring that the defendant does not have a conviction or there's a reasonable probability that the conviction resulted from ineffective assistance of counsel. So, you know, to the extent that there were some messy issues with the continuance in this case, the overriding interest still has to be the constitutional one, which is that a defendant not plead guilty with ineffective assistance of counsel. And it's impossible to look at this record and conclude that Mr. Reed was not deficient in that plea advice, and this court therefore correctly found that he was deficient. And given the impact that advice, that if you're going to go to trial, I'm not going to be able to represent you effectively, as he said, I'm not prepared to try the case next week. I violate my duty to my client. I will violate the code of ethics if we go to trial. It'll be ineffective assistance of counsel. It'll deny him his right to trial. It'll deny him his right to due process. You hear that as Mr. Mason Kimmins. I don't know how you can make a decision to go to trial. And for this court to find that he wasn't prejudiced by his attorney telling him to plead guilty on that basis, that sets an impossibly high prejudice.
Your time's expired, but I'll inquire a little further. I mean, but you're essentially saying, well, there was no way. I mean, once you're advised your client's not ready to go to trial, then there's just no way to do anything other than to accept the pressure to plea. And I think this court implicitly rejected that by a structural error in the argument in the last hearing, which this court didn't agree with that. It sent it back for fact-finding. So if it was so clear, as you're saying, there would have been no need for a remand, right?
I mean, this court didn't reach the structural issue. I agree that its decision to remand is inconsistent with it finding structural error, but it didn't make a finding on that. But, I mean, we're using it in the terms of it's a very compelling fact. It's a compelling fact that has extraordinary weight with Mr. Mason Kimmons' decision-making. But it's not the only thing we're relying upon. We're also relying upon the contemporary statements of the attorney and Mr. Mason Kimmons on the exonerating identification evidence that show this is a triable case. So it's not like we're hanging our hat on that alone. But I do think it is, at the very least, a very compelling fact that supports prejudice.
Well, thank you, Mr. McLaughlin and Ms. Lawan. Well argued. Matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both, and have a good day.